This podcast was recorded at the 2016 JAD Pro Live at App Show Conference in Washington, D.C. The title of this session is What Advanced Practitioners Need to Know About the Diagnosis and Treatment of Patients with Pancreatic Cancer, and it is presented by Joseph M. Herman, MD Anderson Cancer Center, and Amy Hacker Priest, Johns Hopkins University. To view the presentation material or see other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2016. To claim continuing educational credit for these activities, visit education.annenberg.net/JPL16-sessions. And now, we're delighted to bring you this podcast from JAD Pro Live.
Our final presentation of the day in this room is What Advanced Practitioners Need to Know About the Diagnosis and Treatment of Patients with Pancreatic Cancer. Please join me in welcoming Ms. Amy Hacker Priest from Johns Hopkins and Dr. Joseph Herman from MD Anderson.
All right, so we'll jump right in. And I haven't really done this kind of tandem presentation before, so bear with us. We'll probably jump in here and there and talk to each other. This is just sort of how our clinic runs, so it's sort of the same thing. I figure you get a good taste of exactly what it's like. So here you can see our learning objectives. It's to summarize available treatments for patients beyond first-line chemotherapy agents for patients with relapsing or refractory pancreatic cancer. Describe the signs and serious toxicities associated with agents used to treat pancreatic cancer as they relate to mechanism of action and approaches to managing the toxicities. Identify candidates who are considered high-risk pancreatic cancer and initial screening modalities, and discuss recent advances in the treatment of patients with pancreatic cancer that support an interdisciplinary approach. I have been a consultant for OncoSil and also have some royalties from Elekta, and Amy is just Amy.
No disclosures.
So the first case is actually somebody that we became very attached to. This gentleman was an 87-year-old, cute little guy who presented with a three-week history of obstructive jaundice. His bilirubin was 9.6, and a CT scan, which I'm going to show in a minute, shows a pancreatic head mass compressing the bile duct, encasing the superior mesenteric artery. That we did get a PET CT, which allowed us to help designate exactly where the tumor is, which can be difficult sometimes in this disease, and it was FDG avid. And he then underwent an endoscopic ultrasound and ERCP with successful placement of the bile duct stent, and that's in order to relieve the jaundice, and then a biopsy was positive for adenocarcinoma. And here you can see his tumor. This is actually a little bit easier, I'll go over on this side, to see than a lot of the times when we have a pancreatic mass, but just to kind of give you a little bit of an overview on anatomy, these are his kidneys, this is the liver here, and then you can see the aorta. This right here is the celiac axis, and then you could see the mass. And the way you could tell about these tumors, it's a hypodense. It's usually a darker mass. And if you play with the window leveling sometimes, it can be very helpful to be able to designate these tumors and separate them from the normal pancreatic anatomy. And here you could see the bile duct stent. So the patient presented it to our clinic for a second opinion. And this is our multidisciplinary clinic, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, to talk about his treatment option. And I think the point to make here is you could see that his tumor was completely encasing, I think this thing might be dead. Oh, there we go. Completely encasing the celiac axis here. So you could see that for a surgeon to remove that tumor, the surgeon would have to basically go in there and carve that out, which means the likelihood of leaving cancer behind is quite high. Okay, and that's something we want to try to avoid in this disease. If we leave disease behind, it usually leads to a bad prognosis. So why is it so tough? You know, people talk about, you know, pancreatic cancer is a death sentence. It's a death wish. Why is it so bad? And there's a lot of reasons. One thing is that it's in the middle. You know, they say location with regards to realtor and housing. It's basically right in the middle of the body. It's about the worst part to get to. The biology, it's time is everything. If all of you see a patient that might have pancreatic cancer, the most important thing is to get them to a diagnosis as quickly as possible and manage their health, and that's what we'll get to a little bit. The tumor blocks off the bile duct, That decreases the pancreatic enzymes that absorb the proteins and fats that we eat. And that's why these patients, when they present, they've lost a lot of weight, they're very cachectic, and it can take a long time to bounce back from that. And therefore, these patients typically aren't in great shape to be able to get any therapies. There's a lot of treatment resistance. Unfortunately, there's not many therapies for our patients. There's not much that we can give them. And for that reason, you know, for our job, it's been very difficult because you want to provide hope, but you also have to be realistic in what the expectations are going to be. And we don't have a good biomarker. We don't have a PSA. We don't have a great way to diagnose these patients earlier in their diagnosis. And then finally, I think the thing that we both can, you know, is that we have patients that come to see us and they're given so many different recommendations. And because there's not really a great treatment option for these patients, typically there's not, again, these patients are come in mismanaged quite often. So what are the numbers? Only about 20% are what we consider to be potentially curable. Okay, so that's not many. You can see that the number of cases continue to increase, especially with the baby boomer generation. 49,000 new cases now, and it just became the third leading cause of cancer death in the United States. It was number four. And again, the key is a margin negative resection, meaning that you remove the tumor without leaving any microscopic or macroscopic disease behind, is the only way to cure this disease. And I think the most important thing to take home from today is that staging is paramount. Patients are going to perseverate on what stage am I? Where do I fit into this whole picture? Am I metastatic? Am I localized? Because that's what they're going to look at on the online. That's what they're going to look at on the internet. And also, as they go through their treatment trajectory, that's what they're going to pay attention to. So I think it's really important to establish that up front. So why maybe refer a patient to a multidisciplinary clinic, or why create a multidisciplinary clinic within your own cancer center? And I think it's because it really allows patients to get everything in one setting. And so some of the benefits are that we work together. We get used to knowing how to work together and what we're going to do for our patients. The patients at the end of the day, they get a plan of what's going to happen to them. That's so key. They come in, they're very scared and anxious. And if we can help diagnose them, get them down the right path, that relieves so much anxiety for these patients and really helps their quality of life.
I think it helps us, too, to sit in with other providers in oncology and surgery all at the same time, so we benefit from their education as well, so we can move forward and help patients.
Yeah, I think the thing is, a lot of our advanced practitioners, it doesn't really matter if they come from the surgery end, the med-onc end, or surgery med-onc, rad-onc end of things. We all learn together, we work together, and we work in a tandem. So Amy can talk about how to do a Whipple, as well as the advanced practitioner that's with surgery can discuss what radiation is and how it works. And I think that's important. We learn from each other in that environment. And also what's very important is for this cancer, clinical trials are important. And getting patients on trials that will hopefully improve the survival of these patients moving forward is also very important. So this is us, this young guy. This is a couple years ago before I had gray hair. This is me back here. I don't know where you were hiding.
I'm kind of.
Yeah, Amy doesn't like getting in pictures, so she's hiding over in the corner somewhere. But what we do is the patients would fly in a lot of times at Hopkins. They would get their labs, their imaging, and then they would see Amy or one of the other advanced practitioners or residents. They would get a full history and physical. Do you want to take a minute and just comment on that?
Sure. Normally I would see the patient. I would review their prior treatments, their imaging, their pathology, discuss their case, get a good, well-rounded history from them as far as symptoms and even, you know, social aspects. And then I would present their case to the group during the middle of the day, and we'd go through each case. And then in the afternoon, sometimes I would go back and relay that discussion with these patients and their families, and sometimes outside providers, and as well as continuing just to follow up with these patients for reevaluation. If they weren't, say, getting radiation with us now, we would follow up and see them for reevaluation later.
And I think that's the key is, for example, in an academic setting, we do rely on residents to help us a lot, but they rotate. Every 2 months, they come and go. And, you know, I honestly think that this model would fail without the role of the advanced practitioner. You guys are so paramount and key in the success of this. And really, it's building that relationship. And as, you know, in the keynote discussion today, we really do get attached to our patients. We're their cheerleaders. We're their hope a lot of times to help get them to where they need to be, whether that's a curative paradigm or a palliative paradigm. And I think the beauty of this is in one day, we sit at this table and we discuss each patient, and a lot of times we'll argue about what we think should be what should happen next. What this does, more than anything, is it makes all of us be accountable for what we say and what we do. And when a cancer patient is seen independent of anyone else, at the end of the day, you're going to be somewhat biased by what you do. But when you're at a table like this, you have to be upfront and you have to be evidence-based, and it holds everybody accountable. But also it gives you an opportunity to, again, provide the best cutting-edge care for your patient. Oh, by the way, I think the other thing that's kind of cool is we were only able to see about 6 patients a day because it was just a lot of time and energy. But we both took an MBA class together to learn how to improve efficiency of healthcare. And with help of another person, another resident, we're actually now able to see about 12 patients in one day. And it's huge because we can get patients through. And even though it sounds like probably too rushed, we share the workload. We sort of share the responsibility. And that way, everybody has their role, and we're able to get through it quite effectively and efficiently. And still have fun for the most part. It's a tiring day, but I think still do a good job. So timing is everything. Timing is everything. And this is why if you're seeing a patient that has jaundice or a patient that has abdominal pain or a new diagnosis of diabetes, it's really important to get them a CT scan, a good quality IV contrast CT scan, so you can see the tumor, and then you can speed up the process here. So here's a good example of a patient who goes to the traditional clinic. They get jaundice, they see the surgeon, finally get diagnosed with maybe borderline resectable, which I'll go over. Then, unfortunately, they have a liver met, and then they get the medical oncology, and next thing you know, 6 weeks have gone by. When you could see patients in a one-day clinic, they get everything in one day, and you can cut back about 4 weeks of that workup time and get the patient where they need to be. And that's important because there's a study that showed about if you get a scan 6 weeks later, in 25% of the time, that scan is no longer worthy. Those patients have already progressed or something else has changed. And this is that example right here. We found that in our clinic, if you look at 500 patients, about 30% of the patients who came to see us in clinic had either a change in their pathology based on looking at a slide or a change in their cross-sectional imaging that changed their plan or their diagnosis. So again, time is everything. So how do we work these patients up? What's important? Well, it's a combination of all these things. And I think another good example of where the advanced practitioner comes in is as a physician at an academic institution, one of my roles is obviously patient care, but it's also writing papers, doing clinical trials, and all those things. And all those things, again, I could not do without the help of Amy. And helping order these tests and make sure they're done correctly and properly so that everything's done. So I do rely on Amy a lot to help order and organize and coordinate all these different tests that we need for our patients and also interpret. So from the EUS perspective, endoscopic ultrasound is where most of these, we no longer go percutaneously unless you have to. Everybody gets endoscopic ultrasound biopsies, fine needle aspirations. As we move towards more genetic sequencing and workup, more and more patients are starting to get core biopsies, but still an FNA is the most common. In some cases, we're going to put markers, like little gold markers for radiation, which we'll get into. A thin-sliced multi-detector CT scan that allows for 3D reconstructions is optimal, with also what's called a CT angiogram. Well, why do you get all this? It's because, I'll show you in a minute, it gives us much better anatomy and helps us stage our patients more appropriately. MRI is not used at all centers, but in a case where there might be a liver met or you can't see it very well or you're trying to differentiate between cancer and a non-cancer like sclerosing mesenteritis or autoimmune pancreatitis, sometimes, an MRI can also help, and then an MRCP can give you sometimes some better definition. Well, how do these patients pan out? So here you could see these are our pancreatic cancer patients. About 20%, as I mentioned, can undergo surgery. Another 35% have what we call localized, either unresectable or what's called now borderline, which I'll get into. Another 40% are diagnosed with metastatic disease. And then 8% This is what I call the sort of forgiven orphan population. These are your performance status 2-3 patients that nobody really talks about. There's no trials for these people. There's very little but supportive care. And I'm hoping that in the years to come, this is a group that we're going to hopefully do a better job with. So we mentioned the anatomy. The anatomy is very complicated. Here you can see the first thing is to differentiate as a tumor in the head, the body, or the tail of the pancreas. This is important because this would be a Whipple. This is where the patient would have removal of the duodenum and the head of the pancreas and leave behind the body and the tail. Whereas if it's in the tail, the patient's going to get a distal pancreatectomy where you cut here, you don't remove any of this, and you remove this and sometimes the spleen. The reason that's important is the Whipple is a much bigger surgery, as you're probably aware. It takes a lot longer to recover. There's a lot of sort of nursing to get back to normal. Whereas the distal pancreatectomy, these patients tend to recover faster. But unfortunately, these patients tend to have a higher likelihood of having metastatic disease at diagnosis. So here's just another view. This is a cross-sectional view of what we're looking at. And again, you can see how difficult this is. This is the pancreatic tumor here. You can see how the duodenum just wraps around the pancreas. And then you have all these blood vessels that are close by. So it's not an easy tumor to deal with for that reason. And then here's an axial view, just showing you again, this is the tumor. See how it's hypodense? I don't know if you guys can see it back there. But again, it's dense. And then the key part is looking at this vessel interface. Right here, you can see there's a fat plane. There's space between the pancreatic tumor, the SMV, and the SMA. That space allows the surgeon to get the knife in there and be able to remove the tumor. But as that space starts closing in, there's less and less room. This is the CT angio. This is a 3D CT scan. This is allowing you to, again, visualize the tumor and its relationship to the anatomy. Here's the portal vein SMV coming down, and you can see how it's hugging up against the vessel there. And then this is the CT angiogram, which again gives you can see the stent right here, and it gives you a better sense of what the anatomy is. And this is very important for our surgeons to differentiate a resectable tumor and a non-resectable tumor. And then here's just a couple more images just showing you the difference. This is a resectable tumor right here, and it's because there's nothing with the fat plane, whereas here, it's probably hard to see back there, but there's a lot of fuzziness here, and you can see the two vessels, and they're completely enwrapped with the tumor. So again, if you think, you know, you're not going to be able to get that out. And in that case, in most cases, this is palliative, whereas this is potentially curative. Now, there's this new, just to make things more complicated, there's something called borderline resectable, okay? Now, I don't want to make it too complicated or confusing, but long and short of it, a nice easy way to think about it is that here's your blood vessel, this is your artery, and if the tumor involves less than 180 degrees, so if you can draw a line right through the middle, then that's borderline. If it's more than 180 degree involvement, that's considered unresectable or locally advanced. And just to kind of show this a little bit more clean, here's some nice big pictures to look at. This is the tumor. This is the artery. Clearly less than 180 degrees, more than 180 degrees. And then this is also where the tumor causes a deformity on the vessel. And as you can imagine, these two are much harder for the surgeon to remove. Same thing with the vein. Same idea. The thing that's important to stress, though, is veins can be removed typically. They can go in and they can cut out the vein and remove the tumor. Whereas with the arteries, in some cases it can be done, but as you can imagine, if you cut the artery, you put it back together, and there's a problem, there's a thrombus, or it leaks, or it fails, that could be fatal for the patient. Whereas the veins, they can, you know, generally they're going to collateralize, and other things can happen to help keep the patient alive. So what's the risk of pancreatic cancer? Who gets it and why? Vast majority of patients, we don't know. There's some interesting clusters of like occupational people who live near, like let's say a nuclear waste dump, or everybody in their neighborhood is getting it, but I think that's very rare. It happens in a 65 to 70 age range, except for these kind of unique situations. And I'm not going to go through all of these, but I think the one that you might hear a lot of is the BRCA 1 and 2 genes. There's an association with breast cancer. So if patients have a high family history of breast cancer, BRCA mutations, or Fanconi pathway, these are patients who may be more likely to get pancreatic cancer. And then you could see there's some, like Peutz-Jeghers syndrome, which has a very high likelihood of getting pancreatic cancer. So if your patients have any of these, at least it's something to think about. But unfortunately, most patients, it's just happens sporadically. So we see the patients, we diagnose them with pancreatic cancer, we work them up with genetics, family history, we get the scan, we get labs, and we differentiate them into these groups of patients. Now, depending on what they get, it's what we give them. So again, resectable, Generally, they're going to go right to surgery, but in some cases, we give chemotherapy and or radiation, and that's to help ideally select patients a little bit. Bottom line is, most patients do develop metastatic disease. So if we give a couple months of chemotherapy, we see no signs of metastatic disease, then we know that it makes more sense to put them through local therapy of radiation and surgery and ideally get them again to a curative paradigm. The borderline, like we mentioned, this is 180 degree or less involvement of the artery, where if we could just sterilize it a little bit and make it easier for the surgeon to get it out with a negative margin, that could be potentially curable. And then in unique circumstances, we're going to mainly give chemo and either stereotactic, which is a short course of radiation, to these patients. But again, this is the group that typically it's thought to be palliative. What about the timing of therapy? Usually after surgery, we give adjuvant. Before surgery, we give neoadjuvant. If it's locally advanced, we consider it definitive. And again, of course, palliative is what we give when there's not much hope. But bottom line is that we kind of have converged now that if they have localized non-metastatic disease, we're treating them very similarly, where they're going to get maximized chemotherapy, then radiation therapy, and every 2 to 3 months, we're reevaluating these patients. They're coming in to see us. A lot of times they'll fly in to see us, or they'll see their local doctor. They'll send us scans. We'll look at the scans. We'll call them, and we'll talk about what the next steps would be. And then again, the next question is, we keep them on maintenance therapy. Unfortunately, we don't know what the right treatment is right now. And I guess, again, this is why I take into account what the patients want and others. We try to do that. So just to kind of familiarize with what are the most common chemotherapy regimens being used today? And the one, there's these two that are the most common, and the standard of care used to be gemcitabine alone, and it worked okay, but it wasn't super effective. And then there were two different trials that looked at gemcitabine versus FOLFIRINOX, which is 5-FU irinotecan and oxaliplatin, or another trial looked at gemcitabine versus gemcitabine plus nab-paclitaxel, okay? Both of these trials showed a survival benefit compared to gemcitabine alone. So the take home is that these are the two most common regimens we use now in pancreatic cancer. This is what I would fight for your patient as long as they have an okay performance status. FOLFIRINOX is a little bit tougher, and these are really your ECOG 01. There are some indications for ECOG 2 for that regimen. The other thing, just a quick reminder, is that if they do have a BRCA mutation or other DNA repair, a cisplatinum or an oxaliplatinum or a PARP inhibitor are also things that we want to try to consider in this setting. So, as mentioned earlier, it's a very tough place for surgeons to get to, and the area where it most likely comes back is this area right here, which is called the retroperitoneal margin. So we want to generally give radiation to kind of cover that area and sterilize that area. Well, radiation has come a long way. This is 10 years ago when I got to Johns Hopkins. We were treating these really big areas with radiation. And then we got what's called intensity modulated radiation therapy, or IMRT, which allowed us to give very focused radiation with multiple beams, like multiple flashlights coming around and honing in on the tumor. And then this is what it looked like next, which is with IMRT. You could see the tumor here. And the color here represents the dose. So this area is getting full doses of radiation, whereas this area is getting a lot lower dose. When you breathe, the pancreas moves. So we realize that in order to get a smaller margin on our tumor, if we can have patients hold their breath for about 30 seconds, we can actually freeze the tumor in space and radiate it, and that's called active breathing control. Then if we put markers in the pancreas, we could actually, like target practice, we can track it. That allows us to shrink our margins way down, and that allows us to do what's called stereotactic body radiation therapy, or SBRT, and now we're able to give a very, very tight margin. That allows us to radiate these tumors in 5 days now instead of 28 to 30 days. Why is that important? It's very important because our patients can come in, get 5 days of radiation, and go home. Their quality of life right then and there is so much better. And I didn't have time to talk about it, but we've done a couple trials, which does appear that the 5 days of radiation is as effective as the 5 weeks. And also what you can see here is it allows us to really, this is a very large tumor, but you could see it allows us to give a very high dose. The orange is going up to like 40 gray, and gray is like a milligram of medication. It's like the way we describe our radiation. But it allows us to escalate the dose of the tumor. And ideally, in the future, we'll be able to sterilize these tumors and maybe not have to take them to surgery. That's the goal we're trying to get to. And in lung cancer, that's already a reality. A couple take-home points, I guess, for everybody to think about with these patients is that we try to give everybody pancreatic enzymes, pain control. Amy's going to go into this in a little bit more detail. I try not to do stereotactic radiation. If the tumor is invading into the duodenum, it can actually cause an ulcer and these patients can bleed. So I'm very careful. In those cases, I would usually give the 5 weeks of radiation and keep the tumor small. And then again, mention we put the fiducials in. These are what the little gold seeds look like, the little fiducials that we put in the tumor to track it. They look like a little piece of rice, basically. They're a little bit more expensive, though. We had one patient that we actually put them in, and the patient had surgery, and then they kept them afterwards. They wanted them back. So this is what it looks like. We put a patient through a CT scan, and we have them in a little cradle so they don't move around. Again, it's all about target, sort of keeping people in the same position every day. And then you could see this is this is the dose of radiation right here on the bottom. And then along here you have the volume, and you could see that the tumor gets a very high dose of radiation, but all the normal tissues like the liver, lung, and everything else gets a very low dose of radiation. And then this is an example picture showing the stent, and you could see the little gold fiducials, and we're basically treating these tumors with millimeter accuracy. So we're able to give a very high dose, and these patients literally go out to the ball game. Like they'll come, and they'll go to Camden Yards and they'll have burgers and a beer, maybe against our advice. But, you know, they feel pretty good. There's very little toxicity associated with this. So with our patient, this is what it looked like. This was his tumor up front. And after radiation, about 30 months later, you could see he was not in any shape to go to surgery, but he had a really nice response. He lived almost 5 years without surgery. So where's the future going? The future is really, in my mind, it's about genetics and about selection. And so what we're doing now is we're taking core biopsies of the tumor up front, and we're looking at the tumor, we're looking at the immunohistochemistry or the protein expression, and we're also sequencing these tumors, and we are finding that there might be certain genes that will allow us to better select the therapies for our patients moving forward. And along those lines, one thing that we're very excited about is this is a group of patients that I mentioned, the unresectable patients, where there were not many treatment options for these patients. And with aggressive chemotherapy and a short course of radiation, we've gone from, this is our population at Hopkins, historically only about 10% of these patients go to surgery. Now we're up, you know, around 40% of our patients are going to surgery, and these patients are having R0 or margin negative resections in 90% of the time. So these are those patients that have more than 180 degree involvement of the vessel, but we're sterilizing it. The surgeons are going in and removing it, and it turns out the tumor is basically dead. There's not much left behind. However, there's still patients that unfortunately are getting metastases where we can't remove it, or their just performance status isn't good enough for us to get them to that point where they can get surgery. And some of the predictive variables that we found is that if you can get your patient more than one chemotherapy, that tends to lead to a better outcome. And also, if they can get a higher dose of radiation and at least 4 months of chemo prior to going to surgery, these are things that tend to be more likely to get to surgery. And here's our Kaplan-Meier survival curves. So you could see that of those patients who go to surgery, the survival is better than those who do not make it to surgery. So again, if we can quote-unquote select the right patient to go to surgery, then we can improve survival for at least a big group of the patients that we see. And this is also just showing that margin negative resection is better, which makes sense. So the other thing is, what does it look like? I know this is, if you look right here, this is the pancreas tumor, and it's white because it's been irradiated. And you can see how sharp the edges of radiation are. This is normal tissue, and this white area is the fibrosis that has been caused by the radiation. So the other question is, what does it look like under the microscope, and can we maybe cure these patients without even taking them to surgery? In addition to that is, do we need radiation at all? Can we just give chemo? Do we have to give the radiation? And here's another example of a tumor here, and here's the response here. And the question is, do we need the radiation at all? Because some of our medical oncologists were like, hey, the chemo is working great. We don't really need this radiation stuff. It's expensive and we don't really need it. So we wanted to look at this and see if it's really needed. So we looked at the patients who got chemo alone and compared them to patients who had chemo plus radiation therapy. And when you look at the likelihood of having a margin negative resection at the time of surgery or a node negative resection at this time of surgery, whether it's borderline or locally advanced, there was a much higher likelihood of having a margin negative resection and a node negative resection with the addition of 5 days of radiation. So at least suggests, it's not a randomized trial, but at least suggests that radiation is helpful. And then the other question is, can we sterilize a tumor? And does radiation help with sterilizing or causing a pathologic complete response? And here you can see again that if you look at just the SBRT arm having a complete pathologic complete response, unfortunately, it's only 8%, so it's not a big number. So clearly, we need to do better. But if you look at near-path CR, which means there's only some cells that are alive, we killed most of it, but there's a couple cells that are residual, you could see that radiation almost doubled the likelihood of that happening. So it suggests that the combination of chemo and radiation is more likely to be beneficial. So there is a trial that's opening now that's going to be that's open very shortly, and if it's not open in your institution, please consider it. It's the Alliance trial, and it's comparing FOLFIRINOX alone followed by surgery in borderline resectable patients followed by chemo, or the same thing with the radiation arm in there. So the idea is to show that there is truly a benefit with radiation in this patient population. And again, this is just the short course, 5-day course of radiation. So in conclusion, pancreas cancer has a very poor survival, but with better chemotherapy, I think better radiation, and better care, better multidisciplinary approach of care, we can take better care of these patients and improve the survival. CT staging is important to determine. We got to put patients in the right bucket in the very beginning so that they know where they are and we know where they are. That's very important moving forward. Multi-agent chemotherapy improves survival, and SBRT does appear to improve survival in these patients, but we need a randomized trial to prove it. So now we're going to switch gears. I'm going to hand it over to my partner here.
So the 2015 consensus for advanced practitioners, there's about 333,000 practicing in the U.S., and only about 2.3% are in oncology. And breaking that down even further, there's only 217 physician assistants in radiation oncology, so I am one of 217. So there's a strong need for advanced practitioners, especially in oncology, with advancing technologies in radiation and systemic treatments. Patients are doing better. They're living longer. They're living longer with disease and having to manage more side effects, and they're on treatments longer. So advanced practitioners are great for daily, day-to-day symptom management, for direct patient care, performing procedures. They're reimbursable, can act pretty much independently, and have prescriptive authorities. There was also an educational push by ASTRO in 1997 on the Joint Committee for educational implementation of advanced practitioners into your oncology practices. So this is actually my job description cut directly from there. It's a little overwhelming, and there's a lot of random things that I do. But for the most part, in the GI radiation oncology...
Very important random things. Very important random things.
I will see new patients in consultation. I will see follow-ups and reevaluation patients. And also participate in the pancreatic multidisciplinary clinic as well as the rectal multidisciplinary clinic. Big role in symptom management for all of these patients, whether they're on daily treatments or they're just coming through for follow-up or coming in as a new patient. I'll consent patients for radiation therapy, as well as a big part of clinical trials, supporting those trials, as well as clinical trial documentation, eligibility criteria, toxicity assessments.
And if I can cut in here real quick, I think I have to really stress the importance of this. I think some institutions, if there's a separation between the clinical care and the research care. Amy is a co-investigator on every single one of our trials. And I think that's really key to work as a partnership. That way there's an understanding. She understands exactly what medications they're on, what trials they're on, what they're going through. It really is important to really meld those worlds together and not make it a separation.
And it's important later when you're going back through all of that data, you can say, oh, I remember that patient. That wasn't related to their treatment. They had something else going on at that time. So I'll order the majority of the diagnostic imaging, just the way practice is set up these days. When you get results back, if a resident's ordering them and they're off the service, it's kind of hard to follow some of those things. So I'm involved with a lot of resident training as well as tumor board discussions of patients. So the biggest, I think, the toughest part for me is symptom management, especially for these pancreatic patients. So it is a big team effort. In the GI service in radiation oncology, we do have a big team, the attending physician, Joe. myself, we have a nurse, we have a resident, clinical coordinator, administrative assistant, as well as our research staff. And I think it helps provide continuity of care with me on the service. Like I said, residents change, and in our department, it's every 7 weeks. So those residents don't see this continuity of care so much, and there's a big need for direct patient care while these patients are undergoing therapies. And a lot of times the physicians, especially in an academic setting, are tied up with other things and don't have the time to actually sit down face to face. So as you can see here, majority of patients coming in with pancreatic cancer diagnosis, you know, about half of them have metastatic disease. The survival rate is pretty poor. Overall survival at 5 years is about 7 to 8%. So most of these patients are undergoing active therapies. So there's a big need to address their symptom management, whether it be disease-related or treatment-related, and a lot of times it's just unclear. So when you're talking with pancreatic cancer patients, the things you want to learn from them so you can help others moving forward is you want to know their goals. What are they expecting to get out of treatment? How do they want to live their lives? What do they do for fun? How will these treatments impact maybe some of those hobbies that they have? Talk to them about their support systems and where they live. Are you going to be bringing them back and forth to a facility that's far? Can you combine things for them? If they're young couples, do they need family planning? Do they need fertility advice? Do they need daycare advice for their children? So these are important things to consider when talking about these patients.
I think one thing to add, too, that's really important is I know a lot of places will say, I have a tumor board. We don't really need a clinic. We're good. But if you see that patient, having that discussion about that patient can be very different. And I think, you know, having someone who has the experience see the patient up front and say, I know you guys are talking about FOLFIRINOX, but Mr. Jones doesn't want FOLFIRINOX. He wants to go fishing. And oh yeah, by the way, like, he barely got up on the table. So let's be realistic here. And we need that sounding board. You need somebody to speak up. So I think the other part about this is we really encourage people to be vocal, and we have to empower every part of the team. And personally, I value it, because the worst thing is to do something that's going to hurt somebody. And so please, the other thing is, you know, be vocal, be part of that, and don't be scared to sort of say, hey, it's great you guys are having this educational academic discussion, but we have to be real here about what's important for this patient.
And talk with their families. A lot of times their families know better. The patients are pretty stoic at times and don't always express some of the things that they're going through or what their expectations are. So it's really important to sit down with the patients and educate them, as well as educate yourself about your facility services. What things can you offer them as a team? You know, social work, nutrition, pain and palliative care, housing, financial things, support groups in the area. Talk to them in detail about the treatment flow. What is expected in that treatment process? How long is their treatments going to last? What are they going to be doing when they come in all the time? And make sure they have all the education about the department they're going to be with you in. So, like I said, the biggest thing for me is symptom management. And I think a lot of times it's hard to differentiate. Is it disease-related, treatment-related, or is it just a combination of other things? And these pancreatic patients, unfortunately, they have a lot of symptoms going on, whether it be obstructive symptoms or GI symptoms such as, you know, diarrhea, constipation, nausea, vomiting, things like that. Their diabetes, they have a lot of pancytopenias from their treatments, failure to thrive, they have clots, weight loss, fatigue, weakness, mental health is a big concern. And so two of the bigger ones are pain and exocrine pancreatic insufficiency. A lot of these will put patients on these slippery slopes where it's hard to recover from if they're not managed appropriately. So pain affects about 70% of cancer patients, and for pancreatic cancer patients, about 75 to 80% of them actually present with that symptom as their first symptom. And even survivors do have a good portion of pain. A lot of patients have multiple sites of pain and require opioid therapies, and it's a big impact on their functional and quality of life. So pancreatic cancer patients with this big presentation of pain is a really scary thing for them. Even if they're not having pain, they're anticipating it. They're afraid to have pain, and sometimes it's hard for them to express that. So defining pain, you really need to take a good history and physical, find out when their pain is coming on, what's going on at the time, have them create logs. A lot of times they come in front of you and they almost forget that it was that big of a deal before, but then their spouse or partners or family are saying, yeah, they were in a lot of pain. Review their data, look at the scan, see if there's something that you can pinpoint to maybe better address the pain. It's hard to differentiate sometimes where the pain is originating from. And there's a lot of different special populations to consider. They have comorbidities and things like that. I know we've all seen these pain scales, and they're really tough. Everyone is different with these. Sometimes the scales like this might be a little bit easier, where they can actually directly point to the pain or show you in a color scheme of what their pain is like. So like I said, pancreas cancer patients do have a lot of variable pain, and it's hard to say, is it tumor-related, is it treatment-related? They have a lot of generalized abdominal pain, epigastric pain, postprandial pain, back pain, right upper quadrant pain. Do they have a bile duct obstruction or cholecystitis? They can have peripheral pain from neuropathies. So when you're discussing pain treatments, you want to discuss what kind of treatments you want to move forward with and what's more comfortable for the patient, whether you're going to use opioid versus non-opioid actual medications, or are there some interventional procedures that can be considered. Can you consider radiation therapy for palliative pain, or do they have a compression fracture and need vertebroplasty or pain blocks for pain, or do they have ascites that's causing pain and maybe benefit from a drain? And there's also a lot of non-pharmacological therapies, and I think a lot of us forget these things that really do help with pain, such as exercise, physical therapy, occupational therapy, acupuncture, massage, meditation. Sometimes they're not available at your facility, but educate yourself of where you can find these for these patients, and of course, like psychosocial assistance.
I think the other thing is diet. So in increasing protein can help third spacing and help bring those fluids back into the vasculature is also very important. And then I think the other thing is just, you know, we have patients a lot of times that they have pain, and their local oncologist will just give them a narcotic, and then all of a sudden it's getting worse and worse, and it turns out that really it was due to, which we're going to get into, which is the pancreatic enzyme deficiency. So what you're doing is you're just causing them to be constipated on top of the fact they're enzyme deficient. So it's really important to try to differentiate. Is it the pain that goes like through the back, you know, that's like piercing pain, or is it kind of like a lower bloating pain that could be more associated with the deficiency?
So this is the NCCN guidelines for screening for pain, and the biggest thing really is to screen for pain. Screen for pain at every visit. Even though the first time they come through they don't have pain, make sure you ask it each and every time. And if you make adjustments to their treatment regimens for pain, continue to ask them, how is it working? Follow up with them. Spend the time to find out what's going on with their pain. Is it getting any better, any worse? So the other thing I wanted to talk about was exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, which is a big problem for a lot of pancreatic patients. It can be caused by a multitude of factors, and sometimes it's just the loss of the pancreatic parenchyma due to pancreatitis or just inflammation from treatments, things like that. They can have obstruction of the pancreatic duct from either just the tumor location or just fibrosis over time, or surgical injury or removal of the gland with a pancreatectomy or even just a bypass surgery can cause these patients to be deficient in their enzymes. So their enzymes are going to be amylase, protease, and lipase, all involved in digesting your starch, proteins, and fats. And if these patients are not producing those enzymes, or they're not getting into the small bowel to help digestion, they're going to have a lot of these symptoms. They're going to have loose stools. They're going to have steatorrhea, distension, weight loss. That's the biggest thing. These patients are eating well, but they're continuing to lose weight and just malabsorption.
And I think this is very key. We have so many patients that come to the clinic, they've lost weight, and it took maybe a couple months to get to us. and no one even thought about giving them pancreatic enzyme supplementation. So if there's any, I would say if there's one thing that you remember from the entire hour, it's the pancreatic enzyme insufficiency and making sure that you're aware of that and to consider starting them on it.
It's important, and it's easy to start. Have them try it. If it doesn't work, unfortunately it doesn't work. That wasn't the problem. If it works, then it works great and actually can help a lot of these patients with their symptom management. You know, use appropriate dosing, titrate up. Keep in mind the cost, though. Sometimes it can be very, very expensive, so you may have to navigate some programs for these patients. So just a little bit about, you know, dosing by weight, take with every meal. Even if they're taking, you know, some of these supplement drinks, they do have nutrition in them that they need to digest, and sometimes patients forget that. So going a little bit to the multidisciplinary clinic, I'm not going to touch on this too much.
There's time for your video.
So there's, you know, we have a whole team of colleagues involved with this clinic. It's a 1 to 2 day process. Patients come in from all over the world, get their imaging, have a full discussion with all of these providers. And like you said, we started with about 4 to 6 patients. Now we're up to about 14 patients every single week. And that varies from week to week, but we can accept up to about 14 new patients. So my role, I think I already went over a lot of this, so I'll... So these disciplines that will speak with these patients, we usually have the ones that are applicable to their care at that time frame. And surgery is not always talking about a curative surgery. Sometimes they're talking about palliative bypasses for these patients. Medical oncology is going to go through standard therapies as well as clinical trials. And we'll talk about radiation therapy in different settings, as well as our GI endoscopy team. We'll talk about different biopsy attempts, you know, if they need stents placed in their bile ducts or if they need pain blocks.
Or even duodenal stents. In some cases, the duodenum is completely closed off, and endoscopic duodenal stents can actually help palliate and allow the patient to eat.
We have pathology, genetics there, radiology, pain and palliative care. Not only talk about medications, but also interventional procedures, as well as, you know, hospice discussions and things like that. And research not only talks about therapeutic regimens that they have available, it's also quality of life studies that they also have. So some other disciplines that aren't directly involved with the clinic, but are something to consider is interventional radiology can discuss, you know, if these need a pleurics catheter or, you know, drains placed or biopsies done. Big thing, integrative medicine, find out what's available for these patients. Ultrasound can do drains and lines and psych, and nutrition is a big, big part of this that should be integrated sooner than later. Even survivorship programs and social work aspects. So what else can advanced practitioners do with these pancreatic patients? Well, I think educating themselves of what's available for these patients, as well as taking the patient as a whole and with their families involved and understanding their social aspects are big. I'm involved with a pancreatic cancer couples retreat that is a 3-day process for patients as well as their spouses to come together and meet, you know, up to 11 other couples for the weekend. And it's a lot of practical things as well as fun social events. And I'll show you a little bit about that in just a little bit. Be involved in creating and supporting clinical trials, research and publications and meetings just like this, and educating and mentorship of others in the field. So just going back to finishing up, wrapping up, pancreatic cancer patients have a lot of symptoms. It's multifactorial in times and can require a lot of time and attention. And it's nice that the advanced practitioner role sometimes does allow you to have that time. And I think that's important with patients, is really to offer your time. There's this, you know, push with advanced practitioners now with the increasing awareness and how to use them appropriately, especially in oncology clinics. And can help with patient flow and provider flow and overall patient care. And it's cost effective and time efficient for symptom management and can help fill that deficit of increasing demand for oncology patients. And they're useful in the academic setting as far as teaching, publication, and clinical trials. So just a little thanks to everyone.
concludes this podcast from the 2016 JADPRO Live at AppShow Conference. To view the presentation material or see other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2016. To claim continuing educational credit for these activities, visit education.annenberg.net/JPL16-sessions.